Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Welcome to the Depth Dive, the show where we really try to cut through the noise and get you properly informed. Today, we're jumping into a story that's, well, it's as captivating as it is unlikely, frankly. Just imagine this. A national skiing prodigy, someone really excelling, who only decides to focus on tennis at 13. 13! And then just a few years later, boom. World number one. Seriously, it's the kind of story that just makes you question everything you thought you knew about pathways to, you know, sporting greatness. So let's unpack this.
It really does sound like something out of a movie, doesn't it? But no, it's the very real and, yeah, extraordinary journey of Jannik Sinner, the Italian tennis sensation.
Yeah.
His rise has just been, well, meteoric is the word. It really feels like a new chapter starting in the sport.
Absolutely. And right now, as we're talking, Jannik Sinner is the world number one, according to the ATP rankings. He's the first and the only Italian man ever to reach that top spot. That's just huge for Italian tennis. And look at the stats already. 20 ATP tour-level singles titles, including majors like the Australian Open, Wimbledon, the US Open.
Mm.
And it's not just the individual stuff. He's been the key guy, the leader, for Italy's Davis Cup wins in both 2023 and 2024.
And what makes it truly remarkable, I think, isn't just the sheer number of titles, but the speed.
Mm-hmm.
The speed and the unusual way he got there. So our mission today really is to give you that shortcut, to get you properly well-informed about Sinner's career. We want to go beyond just the headlines, you know, really understand what makes him tick, what makes him so unique.
Exactly. We're going to try and pull out the most important bits of knowledge, the key insights, share some facts that might genuinely surprise you, help you grasp his, like, unique path, and hopefully keep it engaging, maybe even a little bit funny, without just drowning you in information. Our source material for this deep dive is, well, it's pretty comprehensive. A rich stack covering everything from his early days, the professional milestones, that distinctive playing style.
The rivalries.
Oh, yeah. The rivalries shaping the current game, and even his significant impact away from the court, too. So, yeah, you're in for quite a ride.
It's a deep look at a truly exceptional athlete.
Yeah.
And honestly, there are lessons here that go way beyond just tennis.
Okay, so let's start right at the beginning. Because Sinner's roots, his humble beginnings in the Dolomites, they really lay the groundwork for this unique story. He was born in Innichen, South Tyrol, Italy, August 16th, 2001. Now, this isn't just trivia. It's really central to who he is. He grew up in Sexton, this small town nestled right there in the Italian Dolomites.
Right. And that region, South Tyrol, it has its own distinct cultural feel. And what's really telling is his parents' background. Hans Peter and Sieglinde Sinner, they worked at a ski lodge. His dad was a chef, his mom a waitress. It paints a picture of a very, you know, grounded, hardworking upbringing. Miles away from the fancy tennis academies where a lot of future stars grow up.
And here's a detail that adds another layer. His first language is actually German. That's common in South Tyrol. He only really polished his Italian later after he moved away to train, which, you know, shows an adaptability that kind of became his trademark later on. He also has an older adopted brother, Mark, born in Russia. So maybe a bit of an unconventional family setup for a future global sports star.
Yeah, definitely. And it's not just like a biographical footnote, is it? It hints at this pragmatic, maybe less flashy start compared to many of his peers in pro tennis. These early influences, the family, the place he grew up, seem to have instilled this blend of discipline and humility, which definitely stands out in the often glitzy world of elite sports.
And before tennis really became the focus, Jannik was a serious skiing prodigy, like legitimately good. Started skiing at three. And by eight, he was competing seriously. Our sources say he was consistently one of Italy's top junior skiers between ages 7 and 12.
That's a massive part of his athletic story, isn't it? We're talking about a kid who, at 7 years old in 2008, won a national championship in giant slalom. And he was a national runner-up at 11 in 2012. This wasn't just messing around on the slopes. He was competing and winning at a national level.
Right.
That early exposure to, you know, high-stakes competition, the intense physical demands of skiing,
okay,
that definitely built a foundation, athletically, mentally.
Mm.
And interestingly, people point to the lateral movement, the balance needed in skiing,
yeah,
as contributing to his amazing footwork on the tennis court. You hear comparisons to Djokovic, who also has that skiing background.
It's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it, to think a future world number one in tennis could easily have been, I don't know, an Olympic skier instead. And here's where the story gets even stranger. Tennis was like barely on the radar initially. He first picked up a racket at 7, okay, but then he actually quit for a year, gave it up. It was his dad, Hans Beter, who apparently gently nudged him back into it, almost like a side thing.
Even then, it was way down the list. Third priority, apparently. Behind skiing and football. He'd be doing ski races in the morning, then football matches for the local youth team, AFC Sexton, in the afternoon. This multi-sport background is really unusual for top tennis players today. Most specialize so young. It suggests maybe a more rounded athletic development, but also he was coming to the specific skills of tennis much later.
So he's juggling three sports, killing it in one, and then at 13, which is such a key age, he makes this huge decision. He decides to drop both skiing and football to focus completely, 100%, on tennis. You know, it makes you wonder what was going through his head. What kind of, like, self-awareness did he have at 13? His reasoning, apparently, was pretty mature. He figured his physique, tall, thin, only weighed about 35 kilos back then.
Wow.
Was actually better suited for tennis. Better than the impacts of skiing or the physicality of football.
That's incredible self-assessment for a teenager, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And beyond just the physical side, he also said he preferred the individual aspect of tennis, where, you know, he felt he had more control over winning or losing. That says a lot about his drive, his sense of personal responsibility, which you absolutely need in individual sports, taking ownership like that so young.
And to really commit, he made an even bigger move, left home. Left the Dolomites, moved alone to Bordighera, down on the Italian Riviera, all to train at the Piatti Tennis Center, under Riccardo Piatti and Massimo Sartori. Not a small decision, but apparently his parents were fully behind him, which must have been crucial. Lived with the coach's family at first, and then shared a flat with other kids, just dove right in.
The contrast is just so stark, right? Before this big move, he's playing tennis maybe twice a week. Suddenly it's full time. His whole life changes. But that intense focus, even though it started later than most, let him catch up incredibly fast. And Piatti, you know, he's a top coach. Worked with Djokovic, Rajonic. He clearly saw something special in this kid, even if he was a bit raw. It's kind of inspiring, really. Shows how dedicated light specialization can sometimes work out brilliantly.
It really does make you think, how many other potential stars might have picked a different sport at that age? But given this late start, this sudden deep dive into tennis, what's really surprising, almost baffling, is his junior career. Or maybe the lack of one. He didn't exactly light up the ITF junior circuit like you'd expect from a future number one.
Huh. That's putting it mildly. He never even played the main draw of the big junior events. No grade ones, no junior grand slams, nothing. His highest junior ranking was like number 133. Which is, you know, relatively low compared to the guys who dominate the juniors. Mm. It just highlights how much of a late bloomer he was. His real ascent started on the pro tour, not before it. It kind of reinforces that idea that there isn't just one set path to the top, you know? Sometimes skipping that junior limelight works out.
A truly unconventional start for a future world.
No.
No doubt about
yes.
it. No doubt about it. Okay, so with that fascinating background set, let's jump forward to his professional career. That period of just, well, meteoric rise between 2018 and 2021. He turned pro officially in 2018, started out grinding in the ITF Futures events, you know, the entry level of pro tennis.
Right. But he pretty quickly started getting wild cards into the ATP Challenger Tour events, the next level up, later in 2018.
Yep.
So you only won an ITF doubles title that year, finished ranked around 550. But the seeds were clearly being sown. Even then, people behind the scenes were noticing the talent. They knew something was there.
Then comes 2019, and that's when things really started to click, didn't they? He wins his first ATP Challenger title in Bergamo, Italy, February 2019. And get this, he's only 17 years and 6 months old. This wasn't just any win. It made him the youngest Italian ever to win a Challenger, and the first player born in 2001 to even reach a Challenger final. That one win just shot him up the rankings. Over 200 spots. A massive jump. It really announced his arrival.
Yeah, that Bergamo win was a huge statement. Bang. Soon after, he gets his first win on the main ATP tour at the Hungarian Open. Got in as a lucky loser, but still, proved he could hang with the big boys. Then he wins a second challenger title in Lexington, Kentucky. That put him in rare company only, like 11, 17-year-olds that ever won multiple challenger titles. These early wins weren't just about points. They showed this incredible ability to quickly translate that raw talent to actual pro-level results. He was leapfrogging the usual grind.
And he just kept going. Qualified for his first Grand Slam main draw at the U.S. Open that same year, so now he's on the biggest stages. reached his first ATP semifinal too at the European Open in Antwerp, youngest player in 5 years to do that. And in Antwerp, he really made people sit up and take notice. Beat Gael Monfils, who was ranked 13th then, his first top 50 win. That pushed him into the top 100.
And the perfect ending to that 2019 season was winning the next generation ATP finals in Milan. He was the lowest seed, the underdog, but he pulls off this huge upset against Alex de Minaur, the top seed, in the final. Finishes 2019 ranked 78th, the youngest player in the year-end top 80 since Nadal back in 2003. Naturally, he wins ATP Newcomer of the Year, gets an award from Gazzetta dello Sport, too. It just showed he wasn't only talented, he could perform under pressure. He was ready.
What a year. Just incredible momentum. And he carried it straight into 2020. Gets his first win in a major at the Australian Open, then scores his first top 10 victory, beating David Goffin, number 10 at the time, in Rotterdam. So you start seeing him not just competing, but actually beating the elite guys.
Yeah, and then after the COVID shutdown, he came back firing, reached the quarterfinals of the French Open, Roland Garros, which was amazing. Youngest quarterfinalist there since Djokovic in 06. Mm-hmm. First guy to make the quarters on debut since Nadal in 05. And look who he beat to get there. Goffin again, Alexander Zverev, before finally losing to Nadal himself. That was a massive statement. Showed his game worked on clay too, and he could perform deep in majors. Just adapted so quickly.
Absolutely. Proved he wasn't just a, you know, flash in the pan. He then finishes 2020 by winning his first actual ATP title at the Sofia Open. Youngest Italian tour level champ in the open era. Youngest overall ATP title winner since Nishikori in 2008. Finished the year ranked 37th. Another big jump.
That period really cemented his place, didn't it? Consistently showing he could be top players, winning titles, making history for Italy. It was potential turning into real tangible success.
And the climb just continued into 2021. That was the year he properly broke into the top 10, kicked off by winning his second ATP title at the Great Ocean Road Open in Australia, became the youngest player to win back-to-back ATP titles since. Wait for it. Rafa Nadal in 2005. That's some serious company to be keeping. Shows consistency.
Then he reaches his first Masters 1000 final in Miami. Finished runner-up to Hubi Hurkacz. But reaching a Masters final, that's huge. Those events are just below the slams. Showed he could contend at that next level. Oh, and he picked up his first doubles title, too, in Atlanta with Riley Opelka, kind of quietly showing his all-around game.
And the titles just kept coming. Won his third singles title and his first at the ATP 500 level at the City Open in Washington, D.C. First Italian champion ever there. Youngest ATP 500 champ since they created that category in 2009. That win pushed him into the top 15. The progress was just relentless.
Yeah, what's striking is just how steady that upward curve was. No big dips. Then he defends his Sofia title, wins his fifth career title at the European Open, makes him the youngest guy to win five ATP titles since a 19-year-old Djokovic. These are the kinds of stats that signal something really special is happening, not just winning, but winning so young. It hints at sustained dominance down the road.
And then, November 1st, 2021, Jannik Sinner becomes the first male player born in the 2000s to crack the top 10. That felt like a real landmark moment, didn't it? Properly announcing himself as a major force. Even when he got into the ATP Finals as an alternate, he made his mark. Youngest player to win a match there on debut since Leighton Hewitt way back in 2000. And in the Davis Cup Finals, he pulls off that surprise 6-0 set, a bagel against John Isner, the guy with the massive serve, only the second player ever to do that to Isner. Shows you how good his return game was becoming.
Yeah, that whole period just showed consistent high-level performance, breaking records left and right, stepping up on the big stages, that bagel against Isner especially, that speaks volumes about his focus, his return game under pressure. He wasn't just promising anymore. He was a legitimate top-tier threat.
Okay, so let's shift gears into the next phase, consolidating that position and then really conquering the push towards major titles and eventually world number one between 2022 and 2025. 2022 saw him making strong, consistent runs at the slams.
Yeah, Australian Open quarterfinals again, second time, right, showing that consistency down under. Then at Wimbledon, his third major quarterfinal. And that run was really notable. He famously went two sets to love up against Novak Djokovic in the quarters,
right,
before eventually losing in five. But that match, even though he lost, showed he could really challenge the absolute best, even on grass. Showed growing maturity.
And he kept that slam consistency going at the U.S. Open. Reached the quarters there for the first time, which meant he became the youngest player to reach the quarterfinals of all four majors since Djokovic back in 2007-08. That really proves his all-surface game, his versatility.
That U.S. Open also gave us one of the matches of recent years, even though he lost it. That quarterfinal against Carlos Alcaraz,
yeah,
just epic. Five sets, 5 hours and 15 minutes, Finished it, what, 2 Predicopy in the morning?
Insane.
Second longest match in U.S. Open history.
Yeah.
And Sinner had a match point in the fourth set. Heartbreaking loss, absolutely. But it also fired the starting gun on what everyone now sees as this potentially era-defining rivalry. Titans clashing already. He did manage to grab his first clay court title that year, though. Beat Alcaraz in the final in Croatia. A nice way to bounce back after that U.S. Open marathon.
Moving into 2023, Sinner really started to, well, conquer. Convert those deep runs into titles. Won his 7th career title in Montpellier, France. Didn't drop a set all tournament, just dominant. Then he beat Stefanos Tsitsipas, world number 3 at the time, in Rotterdam. That felt like his biggest win up to that point. Showed he could consistently beat the top 5 guys.
Yeah, 2023 felt like a real consolidation, a step up in his ability to win week in, week out against the best. Reached his 2nd Miami Masters final. And crucially, beat the defending champ Carlos Alcaraz in the semis. That was a huge win. Stopped Alcaraz getting the Sunshine Double, winning Indian Wells and Miami back-to-back, denied him the world number 1 ranking too at that moment. A big statement in their growing head-to-head.
He also made his first Grand Slam semifinal at Wimbledon that year, another step forward in the majors. But the big breakthrough Masters 1000 title finally came at the Canadian Open, beat Alex de Minaur in the final. That win pushed him up to a career-high number 4. Only the 2nd Italian man ever to reach the top 5, equaling the great Adriano Panatta.
And his run against Daniel Medvedev late in 2023 was another massive turning point. Really showed his tactical evolution. Medvedev had owned their head-to-head, won the first 6 meetings.
Right, it felt like Medvedev just had his number.
Exactly. But then Sinner completely flips the script. Wins 5 straight against him, including back-to-back finals, the China Open and then Vienna. That showed incredible adaptability, figuring out a top player who had previously troubled him. It wasn't just power, it was strategy, mentality. Then at his ATP Finals debut in Turin, he was brilliant. Won all his group matches, including this thriller against world number 1 Djokovic. Won it in a 3rd set tiebreak. Okay, he lost the final rematch to Djokovic, but it was obvious he belonged on that absolute biggest stage.
And then the Davis Cup. Became a national hero, leading Italy to their first title in 47 years. Just a monumental moment for Italian tennis, and he was the guy driving it. During that run, he beat Djokovic 3 times in 11 days, once in singles, once in doubles with Sonego. And in that semifinal singles match against Novak, he saved 3 consecutive match points, just unbelievably clutch under that kind of pressure.
Yeah, those Davis Cup performances really highlighted his leadership, his ability to deliver when everything's on the line for his country. It wasn't just about him anymore. He was carrying the team, the nation's hopes. Deservedly won ATP Most Improved Player, fans' favorite player. His coaches, Cahill and Vignazzi, won Coach of the Year too, showed the strength of the whole setup.
Which brings us to 2024, and wow, 2024 was just historic for Jannik Sinner. Multiple Grand Slams, finally reaching world number 1. Let's start with the Australian Open, his first major title.
That Aussie Open run was just immense. Really felt like his Grand Slam coming of age moment. In the semis, he pulls off that stunning upset of Djokovic, world number 1 defending champ, hands Novak his first loss in Melbourne since 2018. That was seismic.
Huge.
Then in the final against Medvedev, another epic, comes back from 2 sets down to win in 5. First Italian man to win the Aussie Open singles. Only the 2nd guy in the Open era, after Nadal in 22, to win the final after being 2 sets down. That takes unbelievable mental strength, Billy.
What a way to kick off the year. And he just kept rolling. Won the Rotterdam Open right after. Got his 200th career singles win there. First guy born in the 2000s to hit that mark. That pushed him to a new career high, number 3. Highest ranked Italian ever. And he was the first guy since Hewitt in 2001 to win his first tournament after winning his debut major.
The winning streak was just phenomenal. Then he goes to the Miami Open, wins his 2nd Masters 1000 title. Climbs to number 2 in the world, another Italian record. The climb felt so steady, so inevitable almost, built on that incredible consistency he developed.
And then June 10th, 2024, it happens. Jannik Sinner becomes world number 1. Djokovic withdrew from the French Open, and Sinner ascended to the top spot. First Italian man ever, history made. And how does he handle being number 1? Wins his first tournament as number 1, the Halle Open on grass, only the 8th man ever to do that. Then wins another Masters 1000 in Cincinnati, his 5th title of the season already.
Okay, now we do need to address something significant that happened around August 2024, the doping controversy. An independent tribunal found positive results for Klospel, a banned substance, from tests back in March 2024. Sinner's explanation, which the tribunal accepted, was inadvertent contamination. His physio had used a cream containing Klospel on his own hands, and it transferred during massages. The ruling was no fault or negligence, so no suspension at that point. but he did have to forfeit prize money and points from Indian Wells. Hmm. And after that, he parted ways with his fitness coach, Ferrara, and the physio, Naldi. The World Anti-Doping Agency, WA, then appealed that initial decision. What's really insightful here, I think, is how he handled it. The mental strength to block that out and immediately go back to winning. It actually turned into this weird testament to his resilience, you know?
Yeah, a really challenging situation in what was otherwise an unbelievable year. But like you say, he didn't let it throw him off. Goes on to win his second major title at the US Open, beat Medvedev, Draper, Fritz. Becomes only the fourth man in over 50 years to win his first two majors in the same season. And at 23, the youngest ever to win both hardcourt slams Aussie and US in the same year. Just incredible. A rapid-fire collection of slams.
Then he keeps the momentum going. Wins his third Masters 1000 of the year in Shanghai.
Mm-hmm.
Beats Djokovic in straight sets in the final. That win didn't just add another big title. It officially confirmed him as the year-end world number one. First Italian ever to achieve that.
He finished 2024 by winning the ATP Finals in Turin, beat Taylor Fritz in the final, and get this, didn't lose a single set the whole tournament. First time that happened since Lendl, way back in 86, and the first Italian ever to win the ATP Finals title. And just to cap it all off, he leads Italy to their second straight Davis Cup title, completes the entire season without losing a single match in straight sets. Only Federer in 2005 had ever done that before in the Open era.
It was just an utterly dominant year, wasn't it? One for the ages, cemented him as the guy to beat, awards just rained down, ATP Player of the Year, ITF World Champion, Italian Sportsman of the Year, the Sony Golden Collar, twice. I mean, an honorary citizen of his hometown, Sexton. The center effect was undeniable. Tennis was booming in Italy because of him.
And the dominance just rolled into 2025. Kicked off the year by successfully defending his Australian Open title, beats Zverev in the final. Another slam to start the season.
But then, that doping situation from 24 came back into focus. In February 2025, the WAR appeal resulted in a settlement. Sinner accepted a three-month suspension for that inadvertent contamination. It ran from early February to early May 2025. Now, the process itself drew some criticism. Some players, including Djokovic actually, raised concerns about maybe, you know, potential favoritism for top players. Sinner's lawyer strongly defended it, stressing it was a settlement for accidental contamination, not like admitting fault. It was definitely a tough period, but again, Sinner seemed to handle it with impressive composure, despite all the noise.
And he proved his resilience almost instantly when he came back. First tournament back, the Italian Open in Rome, he reaches the final. No Italian man had done that since 1978. Okay, he lost that final to Alcaraz, but still, what a return. Then, at the French Open, he reaches the final again. Didn't lose a set getting there, beat Djokovic in the semis, faced Alcaraz again in the final. Another epic, longest final in French Open history. Sinner lost, despite being up two sets and having three championship points. Brutal. But an incredible effort right after the suspension.
And he just bounces right back, doesn't he? 5 weeks later, Wimbledon, he wins the title, beats Alcaraz in the final this time, becomes the first Italian man ever to win Wimbledon. Just historic. It really underlines that incredible ability to move past disappointments and get right back to the top level. Shows incredible mental toughness. Interestingly, around this time, he also rehired his old fitness trainer, Umberto Ferrara. Shows a pragmatic approach, maybe, going back to what worked.
And his influence was clearly spreading beyond just tennis. He released a single, Polvere e Gloria, Dust and Glory, with Andrea Bocelli. It's pretty amazing. Launched the Jannik Sinner Foundation, too, a nonprofit focused on kids, education, sports. And he even met the Pope, Pope Leo XIV, who apparently is a big tennis fan.
Yeah, these off-court things show him evolving, right? Using his platform, engaging with culture, philanthropy, becoming a true global figure, not just an athlete.
Okay, let's talk about how he plays, because his style is as unique and effective as his career path. He's described as an aggressive baseliner. And everyone agrees he's one of the hardest hitters out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And his signature shot, no question, is that two-handed backhand. What's really fascinating, the data shows he hits it with more topspin than anyone else on tour. Average 1858 RPM, combined with really high speed, too, over 111 kilometers on average. That mix of heavy spin and pace is a nightmare for opponents. Lets him dictate, push guys back, especially those who hit flatter. It's a huge strategic weapon.
And the comparisons he gets are interesting, too, often compared to Federer. Not just the shots, but his calm demeanor on court, his smooth movement. Federer himself apparently said Sinner has almost the same speed off both wings, forehand and backhand. High praise for that balance and power.
And that great lateral movement, which is so key for covering the baseline, That's often linked back to the skiing. Again, you hear the Djokovic parallel there. Both credit scheme for helping their tennis skills. It shows how those diverse athletic backgrounds can really pay off. Oh, and here's a wild fact. He plays with contact lenses. Apparently, he literally can't see the ball properly without them. Makes his precision even more impressive, doesn't it?
Incredible. Now, success like this isn't just the player, is it? It's the team. And Sinner's team has definitely evolved, showing this constant drive to get better.
Right. Back when he made that big move at 13, his mentors were Riccardo Piatti, Andrea Volpini, Massimo Sartori. Piatti, as we said, top coach, worked with big names. They laid that technical foundation, that aggressive baseline style.
But things change in sport. February 2022, he makes that big switch, ends the long partnership with Piatti, brings in Simona Vignazzi as his main coach. Then the super coach, Darren Cahill, joins in July 2022.
Bold move, changing a winning team. But clearly it worked. It was a key part of that final push to number one. Fresh eyes, new ideas. And his mental approach is interesting too. He doesn't use a traditional mental coach. Instead, he works with Formula Medicine. It's an Italian program developed for Formula One drivers. Very data-driven, focusing on psychophysiological performance. Fits his methodical style. Fitness and physio were key, too. Umberto Ferrara for fitness, Giacomo Naldi as physio. Though, as we mentioned, after the doping incident in 2024, he parted ways with them, brought in Djokovic's former fitness guy, Marco Panici, and physio Ulises Badio, plus an osteopath. But then, interestingly, Ferrara came back as fitness coach in July 2025. Shows he's willing to adapt, go back to what works for him. Pragmatic.
And there's that lovely personal touch. His dad, the chef, often travels and cooks for the team at big tournaments. That must be amazing. A bit of home cooking, creating a family feel amidst all the pressure.
Definitely adds a human element, doesn't it? This whole evolving team structure, the strategic changes, bringing people back. It just shows this constant search for the edge, the best support system for an elite athlete who never stops looking for improvements.
Away from the court, Sinner's become a huge deal, a sponsorship powerhouse. Even at 17, he had Nike and Head deals. Then at 18, before he'd even cracked the top 50, Rolex signs him as a global ambassador, like Federer. That shows you what they thought his potential was, even then.
Oh yeah, his portfolio is massive now. That Nike deal renewed in 2022, reportedly $150 million over 10 years. Huge! He's a face of Gucci. Remember when carrying that monogram Gucci bag onto center court at Wimbledon? Caused quite a stir, breaking tradition.
Yeah.
He's got Lavazza, Alfa Romeo, Intesa Sanpaolo Bank. Even Formula One signed him as a global ambassador, trying to reach younger fans through him. Shows his crossover appeal.
And the list just keeps going. La Roche-Posay for sun protection, AFSES Web Telecom, DiCecco Pasta, Panini stickers, Technogym fitness equipment, Enervit supplements, Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, Pingna stationery, Explora Journeys cruises. It's incredible. Shows his massive marketability way beyond just tennis fans.
But it's not just commercial. He's also really active in philanthropy, social impact stuff. Builds his image as more than just an athlete. During the pandemic in 2020, he did that What's Kept You Moving thing, interviewing young athletes about mental health. In 2022, he fronted an Ace for Research, donated for every ace he hit, visited a cancer institute, and then launching his own Janik Sinner Foundation in 2025, focused on kids, education, sport, using his platform positively.
He really seems like a great role model. And in the media, pop culture, he's a bit of a phenomenon, isn't he? His nickname's The Fox, his own logo inspired by it. And you can't forget the Corona Boys, his super fans who follow him dressed as carrots. They get so much media attention, adds a fun, slightly surreal element to his support.
Absolutely. Huh. And a Sinner effect in Italy is real, credited with this huge boom in tennis popularity there. He's been honored by the prime minister, the president, appointed ambassador of sports diplomacy. Interestingly, he turned down an invite to Italy's big Sanremo music festival. Apparently, the Italian Tennis Federation advised him to stay focused, avoid too much media hype. He handled that maturely, too.
The media often calls him the atypical Italian, a label he seems to agree with, maybe because he's so calm, so focused, compared to maybe more fiery Italian stereotypes. He's done features with GQ, short films. There's even a biography, Becoming Sinner. And he's on those big lists, Forbes 30, Under 30 Europe, Time 100 Next in 2024, shows his global influence is growing fast.
On the personal side, lives in Monte Carlo, moved there at 18, says his tennis idol was Andrea Seppi, another player from South Tyrol. He's had public relationships, dated Italian model Maria Bruschini for a few years, then Russian tennis player Anna Kalinskaya for about a year. And he's apparently pretty business savvy too, manages investment through companies in Monaco, owns property in Milan, building a future beyond tennis, clearly.
Yeah, it's clear he's building a major legacy. On and off the court, he's more than just a player. Okay, let's talk rivalries, because they're really defining this new era in men's tennis, and Sinner is right in the thick of it, and you absolutely have to start with Carlos Alcaraz.
No question. Their head-to-head, as of late August 2025, is actually 9-5 in Alcaraz's favor. But everyone calls it potentially era-defining, and you can see why. The clash of styles, the personalities, it's just electric every time they play.
Their matches are just guaranteed drama, aren't they? Often going the distance, pushing each other to the absolute limit. You think back to that 2024 French Open semi. Alcaraz won it in five. Or that crazy 2022 U.S. Open quarterfinal. Sinner lost in five after holding match point.
Yeah.
These aren't just matches. They're like installments in an ongoing saga.
Exactly. Sinner got that big win in the 2023 Miami semi, stopped the Sunshine Double. But 2025 really heated things up. Back-to-back major finals, Sinner loses that epic French Open final, longest ever, after being up two sets with championship points. Gut-wrenching. But then, just weeks later at Wimbledon, he turns it around, wins in four, dethrones Alcaraz. That back-and-forth at the absolute peak just confirms these two are the future.
And there's Daniil Medvedev. That head-to-head is super close now. Sinner leads 8-7. But remember, it used to be totally one-sided. Medvedev won the first six matches, looked like he just couldn't lose to Sinner. But Sinner completely flipped it, won five straight in late 2023, leveled it, now leads.
That turnaround is just remarkable. Shows Sinner's ability to analyze, adapt, find solutions against guys who previously had his number. It wasn't just about hitting harder. It was strategic brilliance. Their matches are always high stakes. None bigger than the 2024 Australian Open final. Sinner coming from two sets down to beat Medvedev for his first slam. Huge defining moment. They met again at Wimbledon, 24 quarters. Medvedev won that one in five. Then US Open, 24 quarters. Sinner won in four on his way to the title. Just incredibly competitive, like a chess match every time.
And finally, we have to talk about his rivalry with Novak Djokovic, one of the all-time greats. And amazingly, Sinner leads the head-to-head 6-4, which is just incredible against Novak. Djokovic won their first three meetings, but Sinner got that first win at the 2023 ATP Finals. That felt like a massive mental hurdle cleared, proving to himself he could beat the legend.
Yeah, that first win seemed to unlock something. They've had some huge clashes since. Djokovic won the 23 ATP Finals final rematch. But then Sinner's stunning win in the 2024 Australian Open semis. Four sets. Novak's first loss there since 2018. Felt like a changing of the guard moment.
Absolutely.
Sinner backed it up, beating him straight sets in the Shanghai Masters final later that year.
And then in 2025, Sinner gets back-to-back straight set wins over Djokovic in the semis of both the French Open and Wimbledon. That's a clear signal, isn't it? A major power shift. Sinner consistently challenging and beating the established giant. And remember that stat from the 2023 Davis Cup? Sinner becoming only the third player ever after Nadal and Murray to beat Djokovic twice in 12 days, saving match points against him too. That just screams a rival at the absolute top. Not just winning, but doing it under intense pressure against arguably the GOAT.
Yeah, these rivalries aren't just numbers. They're the story of men's tennis right now. Sinner has firmly planted himself as a dominant force, not just against his peers like Alcaraz, but against the legends like Djokovic. He's shaping this new era.
What an incredible journey we've covered today. Just think about it. From that multi-sport kid in the Dolomites, not even focusing on tennis till 13, to a multiple Grand Slam champion, world number one. Jannik Sinner's story is just fundamentally unique. He built it his own way, unconventional path, carefully chosen team that evolved, that distinct, powerful playing style. He's really forged a new identity for Italian tennis. We've seen his massive impact on the sport, his growing global profile, both on and off the court.
His career really is a masterclass in resilience, isn't it?
Yeah.
Smart choices, relentless improvement, even navigating challenges like that suspension, the way he just came back stronger, won more majors, led his country. It says so much about his character, his mental game. It's a powerful story of focus and adaptation.
So what does this all mean for you listening?
Well, Jannik Sinner's story, it's more than just tennis, right? It's a fascinating look at how this deliberate, focused approach, even if it starts later than everyone else, combined with really leaning into your unique strengths, learning from every single challenge, even the unexpected setbacks, how that can lead to just unparalleled success.
It really makes you ask the question, doesn't it? In our own lives, where might we be overlooking our own skiing background or our own atypical Italian qualities, those unique things about us that could actually unlock our greatest, maybe unexpected potential?
It's about realizing there isn't just one straight line to success. You know, sometimes those detours, those unconventional starts, those moments where you have to pivot, they can actually build the foundation for things you never even imagined. It's about trusting your own path, however different it looks.
A powerful thought to end on. Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive into the truly extraordinary world of Janik Sinner. We'll catch you next time.